Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. The buzz today is about a BuzzFeed report that President Trump directed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress. The Wall Street Journal reported Wednesday that Cohen hired the head tech guy at Liberty University to rig poll results during the campaign. In his confirmation hearings, William Barr assured the Senate that Robert Mueller would be allowed to finish his investigation, but he put in doubt whether or not Mueller's findings would be made public. Hundreds of thousands of federal employees are hurting, to say nothing of the legions of landlords, daycare providers, and contractors who are also going without pay as a consequence of the partial government shutdown. Paula Reed of CBS News, Lisa Desjardins of the PBS NewsHour, and John Bresnahan of Politico join me. Plus, the acclaimed classical violinist Jennifer Coe performs live when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, it's the Midday News Wrap. A little later, we'll check in with Lisa Desjardins of the PBS NewsHour and John Bresnahan of Politico for an update on the partial government shutdown and the Trump-Pelosi showdown, which at the moment is full of barbs, but pretty short on movement towards a resolution. But we begin today with CBS News correspondent Paula Reed, whose beats include the White House and the Justice Department. She joins us this afternoon from the White House. Paula, how you doing?
Been a busy morning, let me tell you. I can't believe it's only noon.
It's incredible. And you were up bright and early reporting for the CBS news program this morning about this report out late last night from BuzzFeed. Some of our listeners may not have heard about it yet, so give us a capsule sketch of what that report said.
That's right. Last night, BuzzFeed reported that the special counsel has documents and witnesses who can prove that the president allegedly directed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress. Now, Cohen has, according to this article and according to our discussions with sources, but here, if this is true, if the special counsel has this evidence, I think it would be very difficult for Congress not to at least begin impeachment proceedings. Again, at this point, the Justice Department does not believe a sitting president can be indicted. So all of this will fall to Congress, and this is a very black and white kind of criminal act.
Is it also a black and white example or a demonstration that there was, in fact, an awful lot of conversation, if not actual collusion and conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russian officials?
I don't think this specific report really speaks to conspiracy or these larger questions of collusion. But overarching the entire investigation into whether there was any conspiracy or collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia is this list of about 12 people, people who worked in the White House, worked for the campaign, worked for the president, people, members of his family, who have all tried to conceal their contacts with Russia. I'd kind of put this in that same list of, okay, we may not have any overt evidence of a conspiracy, but why are all these people trying to cover up links to Russia? The closest evidence that we have been presented with so far of any conspiracy is, of course, former campaign chairman Paul Manafort. We now know that he passed off polling data to an associate with known ties to Russian intelligence. But otherwise, at this point, I don't think we've seen hard evidence that can prove something as difficult and, again, as squishy as a conspiracy.
This report simply confirms or reports what Mr. Cohen told the special counsel's office. The special counsel's office has been famously tight-lipped about the nature of their investigation. We know a little bit about it from the indictments that they've issued publicly. But what does that mean? I mean, the sources for this are not from the special counsel's office, but this is also a pretty rare glimpse inside some of the testimony that the special counsel has received. Isn't it?
It is. It would be very surprising to me if this came from the special counsel's office, much to my chagrin. They do not leak and they do not talk. But you have to remember Michael Cohen's prosecution, the reason he's going to jail for 3 years in March.
Is a line between the president's actions and the actions of those who worked for him. Is that new?
I see it more as trying to move the goalposts a little bit, trying to go from there was no collusion to, well, if there was collusion, it wasn't my client. I don't know if there really is a strategy, to be honest with you here. I think strategy may be too big of a word to apply to sort of how they're putting their message out.
Yeah, that's certainly fair enough. Paula Reed is a CBS News correspondent who covers the White House, the Justice Department, and legal affairs. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. So, Paula, another piece of data emerged this week in which it was revealed that Mr. Trump, the president, has gone to fairly extraordinary measures to conceal notes that an interpreter made of meetings between he and Vladimir Putin. What do you read into that?
Well, right now, I mean, I think this is just sort of part of the Lawyer Full Employment Act. You're definitely going to see efforts by Democrats on the Hill to try to subpoena these notes. And it goes to this larger question of why are so many people trying to conceal their conversations, their contacts with Russia? There's nothing unusual about the president meeting with another head of state. And in most instances, if he said, look, I don't want these to leak, I want to keep them to myself, people may not have thought that much of it. But you put it in the full context of all of these lies, all of these attempts to conceal, be it the former attorney general, be it the president's son-in-law, and you just have to ask why. So I definitely think that those notes and that interpreter, they're going to be a target for folks in the House and newly emboldened Democrats, but the president probably has a pretty legitimate claim to executive privilege to protect those notes.
So many subpoenas, so little time, I guess. You were at the William Barr hearings, his confirmation hearings to be the next attorney general. He is a seasoned hand at that job. He held it during the George H.W. Bush administration. Democrats were a little worried. They were somewhat enthusiastic at Mr. Barr's nomination in the very early stages of this. They certainly thought it could have been worse. But by the end of the hearings, they had some concerns.
They do. And the biggest concern, it's not about his credibility. It's
that the president delay or change the setting of the State of the Union address, which is scheduled for a couple of weeks. Where does that stand?
Well, right now, the president has really not directly responded to what he's going to do about the State of the Union. He responded that day with sort of uncharacteristic silence. There was obviously this move he made with her trip abroad. But we don't know what's going to happen with the State of the Union. Sources inside the White House have told CBS News that they were trying to sort of toy with the idea of seeing maybe the GOP-led Senate will let him come and give an address. But that would be kind of diminished, right? It's a smaller audience. It's a smaller space. Right now, it's not clear what he's going to do. She suggested he could submit it in writing. She suggested he could do it from the Oval Office. But really, I mean, this would have been a huge platform for him amid this ongoing fight over the shutdown. And we know that his last Oval Office address, the first and only, didn't really win any hearts and minds on the shutdown issue.
And again, in terms of the law, the Constitution requires what exactly?
Under the law, if I remember correctly, I've read a lot of laws this week, but I don't think there's any requirement that he has to be given this enormous platform. Right now, he just has to decide how hard he wants to fight for that TV time. If he really wants to do his address, he could, as she suggested, do it from the Oval Office or submit it in writing.
You reported a couple of days ago that there's some advisors to the president that think that Speaker Pelosi's suggestion that he delay or postpone or change it in some way, to change the State of the Union, is a sign that Pelosi's running scared, that her argument for the shutdown is being attenuated somehow.
Yeah, and I think there could be some truth to that. Some people suggest, oh, this was a power move, no doubt. But it also may be a suggestion that she is scared. But, you know, you have a boss, I have a boss, we all manage up. And really what a lot of that theory looked like is maybe a way to get the president to take a pause, take a breath, and respond to this slowly, calmly, and in a presidential manner, and not punch back immediately.
The president denied use of a military airplane to Speaker Pelosi and a delegation from Congress.
Any strategy to get out of this, and typically you don't want to be the one who has ownership over not being able to govern. I think there's a lot of pressure over that, and today, the problem is people haven't really been willing to talk to us about the BuzzFeed article. So we don't have a sense of how they're viewing this, but some tea leaves that we can read, two White House spokespeople in the span of a few hours went on cable news. They would not directly deny this report, but then Kellyanne Conway and Hogan Gidley, they both avoided the gaggle of reporters. I've never seen Kellyanne Conway shy away from a gaggle of reporters. She is always willing to take us on any issue, and this one they sidestepped. That, to me, suggests they are concerned about this. They're feeling the heat, and again, it does not appear that they have a strategy beyond attacking Michael Cohen's credibility, which, quite frankly, isn't that hard to do.
Real quickly, this Wall Street Journal report on Wednesday about Michael Cohen hiring the tech guy from Liberty University to manipulate the results of a poll. Have you ever heard of other people doing that? I mean, we hear about dirty tricks in campaigns all the time. Is that a common practice?
I mean, we do have to realize that it's something specific to the modern era, right? CNBC didn't have online polls back in, 1916 or whatever. But no, it's a little weird. It's a little strange, specifically because the president for so long has sort of derided these polls. And the questions that these polls were asking were, who is America's most admired businessman? Another one was, who do you think would make a great presidential Republican candidate? And ultimately, this campaign, they paid this expert to come up with an algorithm and skew the poll in Trump's favor. Ultimately, it wasn't that successful. And again, the big question is whether or not those expenses were properly disclosed, how many changed hands, and it's possible somewhere in there could be a campaign finance violation. But otherwise, it just looks a little strange.
Yeah, reports are that he was to be paid $50,000. Instead, he got a Walmart bag full of $12,000 in cash and a boxing glove.
Although Cohen denies. He said he paid with a check. But again, until we have more information about what money went where and how it was disclosed, it's sort of a question mark over whether or not that was a crime or just...
Still for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
So you have been following a couple of new members of Congress as mm-hmm. they negotiate their first weeks on the job in the midst of a shutdown, which is a really very unique and amazing set of affairs. Who are they? How are they doing? And what have you learned?
It's fascinating. There are two new members whose districts are side by side. One is Republican Denver Riggleman. He is a distillery owner, a former Air Force veteran. He is an Air Force veteran, retired Air Force member. And then the other is Abigail Spanberger. She is a former CIA officer, and she is a mother of three girls. So she's kind of a young mom. But her district is Richmond. A lot of your listeners may know her district in particular because that is the district that used to be held by Dave Brat of the Freedom Caucus, and then before him, Eric Cantor, who was the leader deposed by conservative Dave Brat. So this is a district that has seen a lot of turbulence in its member of Congress and its elections. Voters there have not been scared to kick out a member, no matter how much leadership credentials they have. It's interesting because Abigail Spanberger is among the more moderate members of this very large Democratic freshman class. She's in a tricky position right now with the shutdown because the truth is her district is a Republican district. As a Democrat, she wants this shutdown to end, and she also, I believe, would like Democrats to give in some money for fencing. She hasn't told me that, but that's more where her district is. So she's walking a tricky line right now as a moderate Democrat at this moment.
Do either of them have many constituents who are federal government employees?
They both do. They don't have as many as the districts immediately surrounding Washington. But if you think of Riggleman's district includes Charlottesville, and it runs all the way north in a stripe up to the top of Virginia. Spanberger's district is around Richmond, the Richmond suburbs. Both of them have commuters who go to Washington, as well as employees who are based in their district. So, rather unprecedented move of requesting that the president consider moving the State of the Union because of the shutdown. State of the Union addresses have been moved in the past a couple of times in history, but not as part of a showdown between branches of government. And I think it was because she felt that she had political momentum on her side. What actually happened, though, is it sparked this sort of tit-for-tat, it seems to be, war between her and the president. But I think as for pressure, it depends on who you speak to. There are some Republicans in conservative districts who do not seem to be feeling the pressure. I think if you speak to Senate Republicans, that is where the largest nest of pressure lies. And speaking to some of them, yesterday, in fact, I talked to Pat Roberts, who's the Kansas senator, also chairman of the Agriculture Committee. Farmers are getting hit by this shutdown in ways that may not be publicized a lot. Some of those payments they were supposed to be receiving to help them deal with the tariff war, those are being delayed. In addition, there are some questions of whether SNAP, the food stamp program, that whether that can last as long as it may need to. He told me that he just came out of a Senate retreat yesterday where all the Senate Republicans were meeting, and they spent time talking about politics, talking to people like Karl Rove, the longtime Bush advisor. And what Roberts got from that was a message that Republicans need to be concerned about one particular group, and it is suburban married women. After he told me that, I looked at some polling about the shutdown, and our polling, PBS NewsHour and NPR's polling, just in the last week, shows that when you look at suburban women, you ask them, has the shutdown made you think more negatively or positively about President Trump? That group, suburban women, 73% think more negatively about President Trump because of the shutdown. That is a problem for Senate Republicans in particular.
I've seen some other polling that also shows some cracks, some fissures in the support that Mr. Trump received, certainly in the election in 2016, whether or not that support was maintained.
Finished to get the shutdown done. But you also have progressives like Katie Hill of California or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is well-known, who want to march to the majority leader of the Senate's office and present him letters. They do not want to negotiate. They just want government to reopen without compromising at all. They think that it is incumbent on Republicans to do that. So they are not, one of one mind necessarily. However, I think that this is a group that is also being very careful. They are trying not to disrupt Nancy Pelosi's strategy or her strength in dealing with the president. So I think as much as they are kind of very rambunctious, they're very high energy, they're also being very careful. I think they are saying things behind closed doors that they are not saying in public. I know this from my reporting. And they are doing it because they do not, because they're being very careful.
There are reports that the president is worried about a backlash, He's concerned about that. But how about the Democrats? I mean, the president complains that they're not negotiating. Are the Democrats at risk of facing a backlash, given the fact that they haven't seemed to have proposed anything specific on their end? I mean, do we have a Democratic proposal that is out there? Because if there is one, I'm not aware of it. And is that going to be a problem for them?
It is such a fascinating question because that's a question really about messaging. I have repeatedly asked these questions to the Democratic leadership about what their offer is to the president, and they do have an offer. They've had an offer for weeks that is $1.3 billion for border security. It could go to what's called a pedestrian fence, but that hasn't been defined any farther. It could not go to a border wall. A permanent impenetrable wall would not be allowed in their offer. But they have said, we're willing to give you essentially what was in last year's appropriations bill, $1.3 billion for fencing. But what's fascinating is that they're not talking about that. To hear Speaker Pelosi talk, it sounds like her offer is no money does. But the question is a fence immoral in her mind? If a wall is immoral, she has not answered that question.
What about Mitch McConnell? He has been incredibly under the radar throughout this entire shutdown, and there are people certainly on the Democratic side who are calling him out about that. What do you make of his posture for these first 4 weeks of the shutdown?
There was an interesting moment. I believe it was yesterday. I'm sorry, some of these days are blending together. It's embarrassing.
Oh, well, that's easy to do in this kind of news cycle.
Right? It's got to be that same way for the entire country. And where Roy Blunt, senator from Missouri, was walking into Republican lunch. It was Wednesday. And we asked him, he's in Senate leadership, and we asked him, does Leader McConnell feel pressure to try and nudge the president to change his views, to try and make a deal, to be more active in this debate? And Blunt, who was almost in the room he was going to, which is kind of past where reporters could walk, stopped and turned around and said, I don't think Leader McConnell is feeling any pressure on this issue at all. I think that speaks to McConnell. He can have a very cool hand in moments of crisis. Now, on the other hand, we know he is someone who believes that this kind of fiscal crisis, a shutdown, or perhaps problems with the debt limit, he is someone who believes that should be avoided at all costs. He is not someone who believes in leveraging those things. In the past, he has been a force for trying to negotiate out of those. In this case, however, I think he's recognizing that it is the president's stance that is the most important. Now, there's a debate. Should he try to pressure the president or not? Whatever side you're on in that debate, he clearly, so far, has decided, no, that is not my role.
Lisa Desjardins covers Capitol Hill and politics for the PBS NewsHour. I highly recommend the reports that Lisa has done on the three newest entries into the Democratic presidential field, Kirsten Gillibrand, Tulsi Gabbard, and Julian Castro. So you can go to the website, and we'll have a link to it on